The Global Story, with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story, every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and welcome to Focus on Africa on the BBC World Service. Today, our conversations include one with a vet who invites us to see donkeys in a whole new light.
It can fight diseases more than any other animal. But then also the donkey has a very clear resolve. When it knows there is danger, it's really adamant in moving. That's why people say you are as stubborn as a donkey, because it can see danger where everybody doesn't see danger. It's a very, very wise animal.
This follows a continent-wide ban on the sale of donkey skins to make Chinese medicine. We've also been talking about the spike in food prices in Nigeria. An economist says government plans to set up a regulatory board doesn't cut it. Meanwhile, the Kenyan shilling has risen in value. Some say that's a good thing. Others say not if it happens as a result of borrowing money to pay off other debts.
I think we should be extremely worried that the hole is getting deeper. This is a plaster that has been put on a very deep cut that's still bleeding, and very soon that plaster is going to fall off.
It's Tuesday, the 20th of February. First, we go to Lagos. Food prices have been going up and up in Nigeria, and people are getting angry about it. Not as angry as the people of Sudan were when they overthrew President Omar al-Bashir a few years ago because of the price of bread. People are not the same, obviously, and there are other reasons why they were fed up with Omar al-Bashir. But let's not forget, the Arab Spring protests in 2011 began because of the high cost of living in Tunisia. So we've been hearing how Nigerians have been reacting.
There is a serious burden in the country, which resulted to strike or peaceful demonstration, I can say. People are suffering too much. Today, Oyo Ibadan have started, which it was started 2 weeks ago at Niger and some part of Kano.
You cannot get food that is less than 1,000 naira. And the electricity too is so bad. You've not bought the light for like how many days now? You've not been having light, and the heat too.
Just last week, I bought a bag of cement of 8,500 naira. 5 days later, the same cement is being sold, as of today, 15,000 naira. Could you imagine that?
Wale Olusi is an economic advisor and analyst based in Lagos. He's been telling me what's behind the increases and what government can do about them. He began by explaining why the protests in Nigeria appear to be slow burning.
There's a general uneasiness, is the way I'll put it, about the rising cost of food, a lot of basic necessity. And I think the labor union just sent out a notification that's warning government that they will probably declare a protest or some form of labor action. Last week, I think there was some form of protests in the North Central region. If you listen to radio shows in the morning, you know, most of the commentaries clearly shows you how unhappy and impatient people are about how government has not shown enough commitment to trying to palliate some of the, you know, policy actions that they've taken in the last 6 months. But in terms of outrage that will involve street protests, that is not yet out widespread.
So is it a case of not yet, but coming soon, or people will just take it in their stride and try and find a way of surviving?
Yes, I think it's not yet. Potentially, it could happen. But I think the government is aware of this, and they are making efforts. I don't know if the effort will be able to calm the people down. But there's no protest yet here in Lagos.
So is it because they feel that nothing will change or nothing can be done about it? Is that the reason why people are not essentially taking to the streets in large numbers and being angry? Or is it that people can still manage it for the moment?
I mean, I would say Nigeria are generally resilient people. You push them to the wall and just, you know, get into it and continue to try to manage the situation. But I think there's also some level of political sentiment here. Down south here, even though you have the voting that is widely divided, there's a huge population of people that actually voted for this government. You know, some of them want to be a bit patient, hoping that, you know, at some point things will turn around. The polity is divided, but that number of people is significant. There is also the significant number of people, mostly among the, you know, middle class and the youths, who didn't vote for this government, and they're very loud on social media about how it is the fault of those who voted for the government.
So why is food so expensive in Nigeria?
Couple of reasons. One, transport cost has climbed really high since subsidy was removed. Nigeria has one of the cheapest fuel in the region. Before the new president came in, we're buying fuel for, you know, about 200 naira, which is about 20 cents or less. Now it's gone up about three times that price, about 600 naira. Of course, there's a ripple effect on transport cost across the country. Exchange rate is another issue. Between now and, you know, 6 months ago, exchange rate has gone from about 460, 500, but now it's about 1.5 or, you know, 1.6, depending on whether you're buying at the official market or the parallel market. So a lot of prices are climbing up, probably due to the energy costs involved or the cost of transporting them or the import costs in terms of the raw material because of the exchange rate translation. Some big consumer goods companies are declaring huge losses. We've also seen notable major agro exporters like Olam's sending out notifications that in the meantime, they want to stall exportation of basic commodities such as maize and sorghum, just so that local demand can be met and maybe they can, you know, check rising prices
right.
as a result.
Okay. Do you have an idea of, say, what it would cost to buy the products for a typical Nigerian meal? Do you have a way of translating for us how much a plate of food now would cost as opposed to previously?
An example that is easy for me to give is, say, a bag of rice, a bag of 50 kg worth of rice, of course, which would translate to a plate as well for whoever is consuming it. I think that used to be for about 30 to 40,000 naira.
And how much is that in dollars?
That's about $40.
Right. And that's for 50 kgs?
Right now, yes. And now that price is about 70 to 75,000 naira, which is, you know, almost double the price.
And with that bag of rice, is it meant to last for the whole month for a family?
Okay, so it depends. For my family, mine is a small family, myself, wife, you know, two kids, and maybe a relative staying with us, family of about four or five. That could last for 4 or 5 months.
Right,
because
okay.
It's staple.
Yeah.
But for a lot of lower income families, they don't even buy, you know, bags. They buy in cups, smaller bucket.
And I believe that there's even the quality of rice that poorer people buy, you know, the throwaway rice, and that has even gone up as well.
Exactly. That has gone up. Even local rice that produced locally, all the prices have gone up. Not because they are imported, but because it costs more to transport it from the rural area down to the urban centers where many of these commodities are widely consumed.
So what's the government's plan? Because a lot of people blame the government for this, the removal of fuel subsidies, which has made transport costs higher, other broken promises that people cynically attribute to the new government. So what is the government's strategy to try and ameliorate this? Because governments in other countries like Sudan, let's say, have been overthrown because of the price of bread.
That's correct. So governments have been making promises, and I think that's one area where people are getting impatient about. In recent week, I've heard, you know, governments talk about price control boards being commissioned to go and check reasons why some distributors are hoarding some of these commodities. But I think the real anger for many people is that the government needs to come out with clear actions. The majority of the people are not probably feeling the impact.
Right. So what about this new commodity board regulation?
Commodity board regulation won't probably do a lot.
Is it meant to regulate the price of basic foodstuffs, for instance, which would help?
I think it's basically to check if sellers or maybe wholesalers are actually selling at fair prices rather than to regulate the prices.
You don't sound convinced. You don't think that it'll help?
I don't think that is going to help because the country is very big. I don't know the capacity of the regulatory board to be able to actually checkmate prices across the country. How do they intend to do that? How widespread can this control be? It's really difficult to see how that is going to work.
Okay, so if you were advising them, and you were head of research in an investment bank in Nigeria, so you probably had a good look at these kinds of things. How would you say they should start?
So I think one thing that the government needs to start doing quickly is to convince the people that the inflow that they are getting would come back to them. And the people need to start feeling that they can target, you know, transport costs, which is one key pain point. They can set up huge food distribution centers just to compete, to bring down the price of food. They can probably remove the ban on certain food so that food can actually be imported at cheaper prices. I think food, transportation, basic necessity that, you know, people are really, really complaining about. Salary increment. Government have promised salary increment. They need to figure out a way to convince the private sector to also adjust salaries so that it reflects, because that's another big problem. I think, you know, those are three key areas that government can think of creative ways of tackling to reduce the pain and show commitment to the people that, yes, we understand the pain and we are in this together.
That's Wale Olusi, economic advisor and analyst based in Lagos. Let's go to Kenya now, where the shilling has gained in value against the major trading currencies of the world. It's worth more now than it's been in the last 12 years, so much so that some Kenyans, the notorious Kenyans on Twitter mostly, are saying this is the start of an economic turnaround. Now, that should be good news, right? But the experts are saying not so fast. They say we should take a look at why the shilling has gained in value. In short, Kenya borrowed money to pay off a debt. We'll explore those reasons shortly, but just to say that Kenya is not alone in doing that. Other African countries have done the same, but without the bump in the value of the currency. So we spoke to Jason Braganza, the executive director of the African Forum and Network on Debt and Development. Tell us first, you were telling me earlier that the temperature is high in Kenya, figuratively and literally, because the Kenyan shilling has gained value against the US dollar in the last week. Why did that happen?
Well, it happened for one major reason, and that was that the Kenyan government issued a Eurobond to help collect some extra cash that is needed to pay for a debt that is due later on this year. And so the markets rallied in support of this bond that was issued.
Okay, so I'm going to have to ask you to talk to us in human, not economic terms. Okay.
It's basically people...
It's a sign of
appreciated
approval.
It.
Okay, they think it's a good
approval,
idea.
Yeah.
Right.
They thought it was a good idea. And so what it meant was that the shilling regained some of its value against the US dollar.
How much of
it
its value?
Which had lost. As of last week, it gained 20 shillings.
Okay. And is that a lot?
It is a lot in a very short space of time. But if you compare it with where the Kenya shilling was about 18 to 24 months ago, we're still in a very difficult position as a country and as an economy, because it's still weaker than where it was about 2 years ago.
So what difference does this 20 shillings make?
In real terms, not so much. The general citizen will not feel the impact of that gain because they are still having to deal with the high cost of living in the country, high petrol prices, and high cost of prices for basic goods.
The Kenyan government borrowed a whole lot of money to pay off a debt. And so does that mean there was more money in the system and everybody applauded because of that?
Essentially, that's right.
Doesn't sound like a good idea, though.
It's not a good idea. Essentially, what happened was there's a debt that is due in June of this year, and the Kenyan government does not have enough money to pay that debt. The Kenyan government has been going out and asking its lenders, particularly the International Monetary Fund, for example, to lend it more cash so that it can have a higher amount of cash in the bank account. And the reason it's doing that is when it then borrowed using this Eurobond, the market was happy and appreciated that there was a bit of cash in the bank account, because when the time comes to pay the bond, the investors feel that there's enough cash in the bank account to pay it. But so it's not a good idea, because essentially what the government did was borrow from one lender to pay another lender.
So why the applause, though? I don't understand, because it seems very short term and it seems like it's just adding to debt.
I don't think that we should be applauding what the government did. I think we should be extremely worried that the hole is getting deeper.
yeah.
in terms of debt.
I am worried.
So we should not be applauding it. And citizens also who are celebrating the shilling getting marginally stronger against the dollar should also not be celebrating too soon, because it will normalize once the reality of the economic, the prevailing economic situation in Kenya becomes apparent.
So why are citizens applauding this? Because you told us earlier that they're not seeing the benefits of this particularly. Nothing is going to cost less. Or are there people that it suits right now because they need that little bit of wiggle room when they're buying dollars?
Yes, it is. And, it usually helps particularly because a country like Kenya is dependent on imports. So when the shilling gains against a hard currency or a major currency like the US dollar, it means that imports are slightly cheaper. So people who are bringing things into the country will be happy with this. Yes.
So Kenya borrowed $1.5 billion to pay $2 billion Eurobond that's
yes.
due in June. Tell us about this Eurobond. What is it? And how long has Kenya had the debt? And what did it use the money on?
So a Eurobond is a type of credit line. It's a type of way of borrowing money from the international financial system or international market. You know, it's akin to having like a credit card or, you know, in Kenya, we have through your mobile phone application, something called Fuliza, where you can borrow money through it and then you pay it back at a stipulated interest rate after a specific period of time. Eurobonds are commonly used by governments to get hard currency into the hard currency. By this, I mean a global traded currency like the US dollar to get into their economies and then use that for financing government operations, including development projects.
So was the money used for development?
In part, yes. In part, it has also been used for government operations, which means, you know, paying salaries and recurrent expenditure. And so the challenge there is that the monies were not necessarily used in the most productive way and have not necessarily generated the revenues that would have been needed to pay off the debt that when it came due.
So why did they do it? Because, I mean, are we talking about Kenya and the money that it owes in terms of crisis as we do when we talk about a country like, say, Zambia?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, had they not issued this paper last week, there are strong indications that they would have defaulted on the payment that was due in June. And so this was a situation that the government had very little options available to it. The important thing to realize is that this is an elastoplast or a plaster that has been put on a very deep cut that's still bleeding. And very soon that plaster is going to fall off again and we will start bleeding. So it's not a solution in the medium term or the long term. It's only just helped us avoid the default for this payment that was due in June.
Which other countries are facing this situation? We spoke about Zambia.
We've seen Ghana go through this and they defaulted, and they too, you know, are a country that floated a number of Eurobonds last year and in the year before. We've seen Ethiopia that have also defaulted on a Eurobond. So it is quite a systemic problem and challenge that the African continent we are facing. And the reason for this is because we've opted not to deal with the structural issues of our economies. And what I mean by structural, I mean it's what it is we produce. We produce very basic goods and export them. So, for example, in Kenya, we still export a lot of agricultural produce, which is low value. Instead, what we should be doing is trying to move from agricultural exports to manufacturing and trying to industrialize our countries or our economies so that we can produce higher value finished goods.
Which countries are doing it right?
We've seen some good examples actually in Botswana. We did have some good examples there. Senegal is another country that was doing or has been doing relatively well, you know, in terms of managing its economy, managing its debt. There's not many silver linings out there, but there are some good examples that we can try and borrow a leaf out of their books from.
So why is it so difficult? Given the fact that economists can see what the problem is, they know how to fix it. The politicians say they'll fix the problem. People vote for them. Then they don't fix the problem and the hole gets deeper or the wound, you know, bleeds more profusely. And investors or markets applaud when a country borrows a whole heap of money, which it can't pay back. And it borrowed that money to pay back a loan that it can't pay back and couldn't pay back. I mean, it sounds like insanity.
It is, and I think the biggest challenge is not even to do with what's happening on the continent. I think Africa as a continent is so much more integrated into the global system, and that's where the problem lies. The global system has not evolved or changed fast enough to deal with an African continent that is ready to take a bigger position in the system. Look at things like trade negotiations. When you look at how international finance is working, it's not yet ready to accommodate an African continent that's ready to move from exporting agriculture to doing manufacturing to doing industry. And so there's a big structural problem with the international system.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Really appreciate it.
Me too. That's Jason Braganza, the Executive Director of the African Forum and Network on Debt and Development. We're going to talk about donkeys next. Yep, actual donkeys, much maligned, with expressions like stubborn as a donkey, stupid as an ass, and more. But what we're going to hear now will surprise and, I hope, delight you. You may even hear yourself go, "Aw." That's what happened when we spoke to Dr. Raphael Kinoti from the animal welfare charity The Brook. You must be wondering why we're talking about donkeys in depth today. It's because African leaders at the AU summit announced a continent-wide ban on the trade in donkey skins. The animals' hides were used to make Chinese medicine. Dr. Kinoti is a vet, and he was understandably delighted with the announcement.
Yes, it's been a long journey, Audrey, and it is extremely refreshing. It is a great moment for us, but most importantly, actually, for communities in Africa and for animals, especially donkeys in Africa. It's a great moment. It's unprecedented.
Why is donkey skin so valuable?
You know, in Africa, we don't quite value donkey skins because then we don't quite use them. It is Chinese, actually, who value donkey skins. The Chinese get donkey skins, and the first process is that they boil it into a gelatin that then is used to form a traditional Chinese medicine called a jiao. And this medicine is actually taken in various forms. It can be applied on the body as lotion. Some of it can be consumed in drinks. Some of it can be taken as candies. The belief is actually it makes you look younger, so then increases your vitality, increases for men libido. The problem with all this is that it's traditional beliefs. It's not scientifically proven, but then the belief system in China is very, very strong around it.
So tell me this. Do you think that the ban will hold, given that many African governments saw this increase in demand from China as an economic opportunity, and they opened legal slaughterhouses on the continent in order to facilitate the trade? So do you think that going from encouraging it to a continent-wide ban, that the ban will actually hold?
The beauty is that actually these have been discussions by African governments, because then even the final decision was done by African governments. And I can assure you, the first continental meeting was held in 1st and 2nd of December 2022. So it's gone through a long process. African governments know what they are saying. I think they are serious about it.
Do you? We've spoken about there were slaughterhouses that were opened in order to cater for the demand.
Slaughterhouses that were open to cater for the demand, but Audrey, if you look around Africa, already 14 countries, even after opening the slaughterhouses, they closed to them. You know, Chinese traders come to Africa and they paint this wonderful, great picture that actually donkey is going to be very valuable and communities are going to get money, governments are going to get revenue and all this. But then a year down the line, governments discover actually revenue is not coming. Communities are losing livelihoods. That has been repeated severally.
Just talk to us about the history of the donkey on the continent. Of course, it's a working animal, a beast of burden, as it were.
One of the facts, actually, is that if you trace the domestication of all the livestock that we have in the world, is only the donkey that actually was first domesticated in Africa 7,000 years ago. But then now the donkey has been developed in Africa for a long period of time, and it has really adapted itself. If you look at the whole morphology, the look of the donkey, is adapted to living in Africa. A short animal, his skin color to reflect sun, but then long ears, actually, because then the donkey lives in very arid areas, so that then a call by a donkey very far can be heard by another donkey from very far. And actually, those ears are even for cooling the body, you know, but then also for hearing any noises from very far, or these, even the call, the bray of the donkey, is for us for communication, one animal to the other one. Very adopted short limbs to climb rocky areas and all these tough hooves for that purpose. A horse can't survive in the terrain that the donkey survives, because then it has longer limbs and so it can fall over. So the donkey is so adapted to living in very, very arid, very difficult conditions, and so is a truly African animal.
And it's very valuable, right? Because apparently a study in Ethiopia showed that if you measure the economic value of a donkey, it showed that owning one could mean the difference between destitution and a modest livelihood. So it is actually a very valuable animal because it contributes to a family's wealth. And it's not often regarded as that in the same way as one would say with goats and cows. Where I come from, cows are very valuable in South Africa.
That's for sure. Actually, donkeys are not as valued. Why? Because then most of the communities don't derive meat from it or milk from it, though the milk is medicinal, actually is used medicinally in quite a good number of communities around Africa. But then because of this resilience of the animal, I'm a veterinarian, like I tell you, Audrey, in my veterinary life, I can count the number of community members who have come asking me to treat a donkey because it's sick. It can fight diseases more than any other animal.
Wow. I didn't realize. So it doesn't get sick. It doesn't break anything. It works and works and works. And apparently it's quite clever. It has a good memory. It has the ability to learn. And yet, one of the insults that I remember from school, not directed at me, obviously, but, you know, the nuns that taught us saying, you know, somebody was as stupid as a donkey. Why did it have that reputation?
Now, you know, when you're calm and cool and obedient and everything, everybody calls you foolish. But then also the donkey has a very clear resolve. When it knows there is danger, it's really adamant in moving. That's why people say you are as an adamant as a donkey.
As stubborn as a donkey.
As stubborn as a donkey, because it can see danger where everybody doesn't see danger. That has developed over time. It's a very, very wise animal.
Well, I must tell you that your advocacy on behalf of donkeys has been astonishing. I'm thinking now, I see donkeys in a whole new light. And I think that people listening, including my producer and the studio manager, they're listening wide-eyed and quite moved. Do you think that that's what's happening with African governments saying that we won't slaughter donkeys for skin anymore? Is it a recognition of just how valuable they are in development, actually?
I can tell you for sure Africa is rediscovering this animal. I'll give you an example of a country that we actually worked with closely when they were deciding to ban or to let their slaughterhouse continue, Tanzania. Tanzania had opened two slaughterhouses, and we went there and said, you know, this thing is going to cause problems for you. And they said, fine, we'll do a small little workshop. Come tell us about the donkey. Tell us why we should keep the donkey. And we came up with clear numbers drawn from Tanzanian villages and communities and all these, and got testimonies from communities. And the government said, we must ban this trade tomorrow. And actually, in a month's time, they had banned the trade. The thing is that this animal is so valuable, extremely valuable, so valuable like the air we breathe. You know, the air we breathe, we don't recognize it's there. You realize its importance when you lose it. That's the whole thing about the donkey. And for ages in Africa, the donkey has never been traded with. Like in my community where I grew up, traditionally we don't sell donkeys because then it's like selling a cup of water to someone. Mm. So valuable, so critical that actually you don't even put any value on the donkey.
Okay, so why was it so easy then for Chinese traders to persuade people to sell donkey hides?
You know, Chinese traders actually didn't persuade people. They persuaded governments. But then now when governments accept trade in donkeys, then communities somehow trust governments and initially begin to sell donkeys. Communities then began getting gangs who are poaching donkeys. So they'll go and steal donkeys at night, because then you find also in quite a good number of rural areas in Africa, the donkeys are very, very close companion of the woman, because it helps in household chores, getting water to the house, firewood to the house. All those things are done by women. So then women are complaining. Like one of our major campaigns actually has been amplifying the voice of women in rural Africa to tell their governments actually that this trade is injuring us as women.
Fantastic. You know? I can't tell you how valuable and interesting I found this conversation. Thank you so much. Dr. Raphael Kinoti from the animal welfare, The Brook, in East Africa. Focus on Africa was put together by Stefania Okereke and Rob Wilson here in London. Charles Kitonga did his bit from Nairobi. Carney Sharp made sure it all came together. Our technical producer, Nick Randall, got us on air and online in time. You can listen to the Focus on Africa podcast wherever you find your other favorite listens. And while you're at it, do subscribe. Alice Muthengi and Andre Lombard are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again tomorrow.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down.
I don't think we realized what the true flavor of Wyoming was back in 1969.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
There was a rebel Confederate flag being flown.
It was different. It was definitely different.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.